Usually when we talk about a highlight reel play in sports, there's this undeniable expectation of raw, visible power.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. Like think about baseball for a second. You watch a batter crush a home run, the bat cracks, the ball just launches into the upper deck, and the radar gun flashes 110 miles per hour off the bat.
Yeah, we're completely obsessed with the radar gun.
We really are. We love the visible metrics of pure, unadulterated force. We like to think that, whoever hits the hardest, throws the fastest, or shoots the heaviest is naturally just going to win.
Which makes sense intuitively.
Exactly. But then you step into the world of ice hockey. You start looking at how goals are actually scored against modern, highly technical goaltenders. And suddenly you realize that the radar gun is completely lying to you.
It's lying to you and it's making you a worse player.
Yeah. We are looking at a landscape today where the hardest shot is frequently the worst option on the table. And the actual mechanics of putting a puck into a net are deeply, wonderfully counterintuitive.
It really forces a complete rewiring of how you evaluate the game. I mean, if you are stepping onto the ice chasing shot speed as your primary metric, you're playing a game that modern goaltenders solved a decade ago.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. We have a very specific, ambitious mission for you today. We are going to completely deconstruct the art and science of ice hockey shooting top to bottom.
Yeah, but we should be really clear. This is not a basic summary of how to hold a stick.
No, not at all.
Right.
Or like where to put your feet. We are building a masterclass designed to fundamentally change how you process the game in real time.
Right. We're going to explore the microscopic biomechanics of a wrist shot, the actual geometry of the offensive zone, and the incredibly complex rule books that govern the blue paint.
Which is a huge part of it.
It is, and it's a vital distinction to make right at the start. Shooting a puck isn't just one skill, it's actually two distinct skills that get dangerously lumped together in coaching.
Okay, break that down for me.
So first, you have the mechanical act. That's the physics of sending a vulcanized rubber disc from a composite stick to the net.
The physical motion.
Exactly. But second, and arguably far more critical, is the cognitive act of shot
The
selection.
mental side.
Yeah, the real-time processing of knowing what is actually worth taking. I mean, you can have flawless NHL-level mechanics, but if you unleash that shot from a mathematically dead zone,
Or shoot right into a blocked lane.
right, then you haven't taken a good shot. You've just voluntarily handed possession back to the opposing team.
So we really have to marry the physical and the mental.
Absolutely.
By the end of this deep dive, you're going to understand the telemetry of how a goalie reads a shooter, the precise biomechanics of your core shots, the spatial analytics of the offensive zone, and how to navigate the absolute minefield of rule variations out there.
The rules are wild. We're going to look at the NHL, the IIHF, USA Hockey, Hockey Canada, and even adult rec rules like Starfae.
Because a shot that makes you the hero on a Friday night in one league might literally get you suspended in another.
Literally. We are giving you an integrated mental model today. You can't just isolate the hands.
Right.
You have to understand the hands within the context of the ice geography, the goaltender psychology, and the referee's rule book.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start by challenging that radar gun fallacy we talked about. Before we can even begin to talk about the physical mechanics of a shot, we really have to understand the adversary.
A goalie.
Yeah, we have to understand how a goaltender actually stops a puck. Because that singular mechanism basically dictates everything else a shooter does.
It dictates everything. The foundational principle you need to internalize, like the concept that should govern every single offensive decision you make, is that release speed beats shot speed. Always.
Release speed over shot speed. Okay.
Yeah. Casual observers have this mental image of a goaltender reacting to a puck while it's in flight.
Like a batter tracking a fastball in baseball.
Exactly like that. But a highly trained goaltender doesn't really react to the puck in flight. The human reaction time barely even allows for that.
Wait, really? So what are they reacting to?
They read the shooter.
Oh, so they're gathering telemetry before the puck even leaves the blade.
Exactly that. They're analyzing a massive data set in fractions of a second. They watch the angle of your shoulders. They watch the positioning of your hips.
Looking for flues.
Yeah. They track your top hand to see if it drops. They watch the blade of your stick and they map your weight transfer.
That is a lot to process in half a second.
It is, but they're trained for it. They process all of those visual cues to push, slide, and get their body completely set, square, and anchored to the ice before the puck ever releases.
Okay, I see. So they aren't saving the physical shot, they are saving the read.
That is the perfect way to phrase it. If your shot arrives at the net after the goaltender has established their square position, it's going to be a routine save at almost any velocity.
So even if I absolutely blast it.
Yeah, you could wind up and fire a 90 mile per hour absolute rocket, but if it takes you 0.7 seconds to load and release it, the goalie's going to swallow easily.
Because I gave them time to set up.
Right. You gave them almost a full second of warning to read the telemetry and anger their mass. But conversely, a 70 mile per hour shot with a lightning fast 0.3 second release will consistently beat them.
Because it arrives before they're ready.
Exactly. It arrives at the net before their internal biological clock tells them they need to be perfectly set.
Okay, so if I'm a player listening to this, conceptually I agree. I want that 0.3 second release. But how do I practically achieve that on the ice?
Right, it's not just swinging your arms faster.
Yeah, I imagine the solution isn't just telling my arms to move twice as fast. There has to be an efficiency element here.
It is entirely about removing physical redundancies. The very first habit you have to break is what we call gathering the puck.
You mean when a player receives a pass, settles it down, and kind of lines it up?
Yes. That settling phase is the ultimate release killer. A player receives the puck, they take a split second to cradle it, they look up at the net, they shift their feet into a shooting stance, and then they initiate the shot. Every single one of those micro adjustments acts as a glaring warning light to the goalie.
It's like giving them free frames of data.
Exactly. To speed up your release, you have to learn the physical skill of shooting off the puck you already have.
Exactly where it
Yeah,
lies.
from the exact posture you are currently in.
You just have to eliminate the pre-shot routine entirely. And I assume this ties directly into the concept of keeping your feet moving.
Oh, absolutely.
Because whenever I watch amateur hockey, the loudest tell in the building is a player gliding into the slot and then completely stopping their skates to take a shot.
It is the equivalent of a neon sign. When a player stops moving their feet to plant for a shot, every player on the ice, and especially the goaltender, reads it instantly.
You're just broadcasting your intent.
You are. To defeat the goalie's internal clock, you must learn to release the puck mid-stride while your body is still actively moving forward or laterally.
My brain is snagging on a physics problem here, though.
What's that?
If I don't plant my feet, I feel like I'm robbing myself of the ability to torque my hips and generate power. It feels like I'd be shooting entirely with my arms.
Well, you do sacrifice a small degree of rotational torque when you shoot mid-stride.
Okay, so there is a trade-off.
There is. But remember the paradigm here. You're trading a marginal amount of power for a massive amount of surprise.
Right. Release speed beats shot speed.
Exactly. Plus, the forward momentum of your body actually compensates for some of that lost torque. But more importantly, you gain that half-second advantage.
Because the goalie is waiting for the stop.
Yes. The goaltender's brain is conditioned to wait for the stop and plant. If you fire while your feet are still crossing over, you bypass their trigger mechanism completely.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
Now, that leads to one of the most fascinating concepts in our source material. And it's something that, frankly, violates everything I was taught in minor hockey.
Shooting off the wrong foot.
Yes. Every coach on the planet teaches a right-handed shooter to transfer their weight onto their left foot, their front foot, as they step into a shot.
Right, it's the classic textbook power transfer.
But the analytics suggest we should be doing the opposite.
Well, the textbook is mechanically correct if your only goal is maximum structural force.
Right.
Transferring from the back foot to the front foot creates a perfect kinetic chain. But again, we are optimizing for deception, not just force.
So how does the wrong foot help with deception?
When you release a shot off the wrong foot, meaning you are a right-handed shooter and you release the puck while your weight is fully planted on your right skate, you cause a catastrophic disruption to the goalie's timing.
Because it visually breaks the kinetic chain they are trained to look for.
Precisely. You're releasing the puck at a moment in your skating stride when the goalie's subconscious brain is screaming, "A shot is not physically possible from this body position."
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you forfeit some raw velocity, but you buy an incredibly valuable moment of total visual confusion.
That's wild. And if we want to add another layer of confusion, these sources highlight the concept of lateral deception right before the release.
Yes.
Explain how changing the puck's angle by just a few inches affects a goaltender who is completely squared up to you.
Okay, think about the geometry of a goaltender's stance. They spend that half second of your approach aligning their absolute center of mass to the exact origin point of the puck on your blade.
Right.
They're drawing an imaginary line from the puck to the center of the net and placing themselves squarely on it.
Okay, I'm picturing that.
If you pull the puck laterally, say 15 to 30 centimeters, or about 6 to 12 inches, in toward your feet just a millisecond before you snap your wrists, you have instantly changed that origin point.
You've shifted the starting point of the geometric line.
Exactly. And because you did it instantly, the goalie's carefully established angle is now fundamentally incorrect by exactly that many inches.
So they are perfectly square to where the puck was, not where it is.
Yes. You break their set position without making them physically move.
That is brilliant. Okay, so what should we remember here? Let's synthesize this first piece of the mental model. If your goal out there is to simply hit the puck as hard as you can, you are playing into the goaltender's hands. The elite shooter's objective is to surprise the goalie, to circumvent their telemetry.
Absolutely.
And you do that by refusing to gather the puck, shooting mid-stride, experimenting with same-foot releases to break their rhythm, and dragging the puck laterally to destroy their geometric angle.
That is the absolute foundation of modern scoring. But, you know, understanding why you need a deceptive release is only half the battle.
Right, we need to know how.
Exactly. Now we have to dig into the actual biomechanics of how to execute the shots that produce that deception.
Let's do it. Let's look at the core arsenal, starting with the fundamental building block of all offensive hockey, the wrist shot.
The classic.
Yeah. This is the shot that requires the least amount of space and offers the highest degree of controlled accuracy. Walk us through the kinetic chain of a proper wrist shot.
Okay, so it begins with runway. The puck must start behind your back foot. It needs to be cupped slightly on the flat portion of your blade, usually from the heel to the middle.
What happens if it's not?
Well, if you position the puck right beside your front foot, you have no runway to accelerate the mass. You are basically just pushing it.
Okay, so the puck is loaded back. Where are the hands and what is the torso doing?
Your hands need to be comfortably spaced. The top hand is anchored near the butt end of the shaft, and the bottom hand sits about 30 to 35 centimeters below it.
Like a foot or so down?
Yeah. And the grip is firm, but absolutely not white-knuckled. If your grip is too rigid, your wrists cannot roll, and a wrist shot requires that violent rolling action.
So keep the wrists loose enough to snap.
Right. The motion begins by sweeping the puck forward along the ice. The puck does not leave the blade during this phase. Simultaneously, you are transferring your body weight from your back leg through your core to your front leg.
This is where the stick comes into play as a tool, not just a lever, right?
Yes. The stick is a highly engineered spring. While you sweep the puck forward, you actively push down and forward with your bottom hand while pulling back and in against your body with your top hand.
You're flexing it.
You are. This opposing force bends the carbon fiber shaft. You are storing potential energy in the stick.
Like pulling back a bowstring.
Exactly. As the puck reaches your front foot, it rolls naturally from the heel toward the toe of the blade, and you violently snap your wrists over. The blade face closes toward the target, the shaft unloads its stored energy, and the puck is launched with a tight, flat spin.
Now this brings us to an incredible piece of biomechanical research in the source material. And it fundamentally shatters a coaching myth I've heard 1,000 times.
Oh, the blade angle myth.
Yes. When I was a kid, every coach told me that the angle of the stick's blade at the exact millisecond the puck leaves it dictates how high the shot goes.
Right. They taught it like a golf club.
Exactly. If you open the face of a pitching wedge, the ball goes high. If you close the face, it stays low. But the data says this is completely wrong for a wrist shot.
It is a brilliant example of how intuition can mislead us. The sources point to a detailed biomechanical study conducted at McGill University by Michaud, Paquette, Purcell, and Turcotte. Now, we have to caveat this, as any good analyst should. This was a laboratory study of 25 male varsity and recreational players taking stationary wrist shots.
So they weren't measuring slap shots on the fly in a game.
Right. But the findings regarding the wrist shot were definitive. They found that the end blade orientation at the moment of puck release does not predict the trajectory or the accuracy of the shot.
Wow. So if the final angle of the blade doesn't determine the height, what does?
Yeah.
Because clearly, players can aim high or low.
The flaw in the golf analogy is contact time. When a golf club strikes a ball, the collision lasts for roughly 10 milliseconds.
Super fast.
It is an explosive, instantaneous strike, which means the static angle of the club face at impact is the primary determinant of launch angle. But a hockey blade during a wrist shot is in continuous contact with the puck for approximately 180 milliseconds.
Which is an absolute eternity in physics.
It really is. The blade is continuously turning and rotating throughout that entire 180 millisecond contact period.
So it's not a strike at all. It's more akin to a lacrosse player cradling the ball in the mesh, guiding its path right up until the point it snaps out of the pocket.
A lacrosse stick is the perfect mental image. The puck is being dynamically steered.
Steered. I like that.
Yeah. The McGill study concluded that what actually predicts the height of the shot is the dynamic change how the blade turns through the contact phase, combined with the bending of the shaft and the arc of the follow-through.
It's the whole motion.
Yes. It is the dynamic motion, not a static snapshot of an angle at the end.
You know, there's a funny side note in the sources about the drama of getting this study published.
Yeah, the data flip.
Yeah. Apparently, the original draft had some glaringly contradictory numbers. In the abstract, it claimed shooters aiming high were more accurate, citing a 67% to 45% difference.
Right.
But deep in the discussion section, it flipped those numbers and claimed aiming low was more accurate, 65% to 45%. The peer review process caught the mess, and the final published journal simply removed the comparison entirely rather than untangle it.
It serves as a gentle reminder that even peer-reviewed sports science requires a critical eye.
For sure.
But the practical takeaway for the player on the ice remains rock solid. Do not obsess over the static angle of your blade.
Use your follow-through to steer the puck.
Exactly. If you finish your follow-through low, with your hands pointing toward the ice, the puck will stay low. If you finish with your hands high, pointing at the crossbar, the puck will rise.
That is so much easier to control.
It is. The human nervous system can reliably reproduce a whole arm follow-through motion. It cannot reliably control a microscopic 12-degree blade angle variation in a fraction of a second.
Okay, let's move to what the sources call the modern default, the snapshot.
Hmm.
If the wrist shot is the foundation, the snapshot seems to be the evolution tailored specifically for today's faster game.
It is the ultimate compromise weapon. The modern snapshot delivers nearly the concussive power of a full slap shot, but with the deceptive hyper-fast release time of a wrist shot.
How does it do both?
The fundamental difference lies in the setup. A wrist shot requires that long, sweeping runway behind the body. A snapshot requires almost no space.
Because the puck is already in your natural stick handling radius.
Exactly. The puck sits slightly to the side or just behind your skates, precisely where it naturally rests when you are stick handling with your chest facing the net.
So you're already in a good stance.
You are already in an attacking athletic posture. You aren't turning your shoulders and broadcasting a sweeping motion.
But without that long runway to build momentum, how are you generating the kinetic energy?
You rely much more heavily on the stick's engineering. You drop your bottom hand lower down the shaft to increase leverage.
Okay.
Instead of a long sweep, you drop the blade of the stick forcefully onto the ice, just a fraction of an inch behind the puck.
To just slam it down.
Basically, you violently bear down with your core, snapping your wrists to load the shaft and pushing through the puck. You are cocking a high tension spring and releasing it in one explosive movement.
Now, there is a notable divide in the coaching community regarding the snapshot, specifically about the feet. How should a player manage their weight transfer when they don't have time for a full stride?
It is an ongoing philosophical debate. One camp argues that for absolute maximum release speed, you should transfer your weight onto the leg closest to the puck.
So if the puck is on your right side, shift onto your right leg.
Right. This defies traditional power mechanics, but it allows you to get the shot off a microsecond faster.
And the other camp?
The opposing camp argues that you should always maintain the traditional back-to-front weight transfer to ensure sufficient power to beat the goalie, even on a snapshot.
Okay, so who is right? If I'm listening to this and I want to build the right habit, which camp do I join?
The context of the play dictates the correct choice.
Depends.
Exactly. If you are in the high slot and you have a clear beat of time, utilize the back-to-front transfer for maximum velocity.
Take the time if you have it.
But if you are under heavy pressure, the time it takes to shift your weight onto the correct foot will result in a blocked shot.
So in tight spaces.
Shoot off whichever foot currently holds your body weight. The only universal consensus is that shooting completely flat-footed, relying solely on your arm muscles with zero lower body engagement, is structurally flawed and will result in a weak shot.
Never shoot flat-footed.
Got it.
Rounding out the core arsenal is a shot the sources describe as criminally neglected, the backhand.
Oh, it really is.
Why is this shot so rare at the amateur level, yet so lethal at the elite level?
It is entirely an issue of repetition volume. Players grow up taking tens of thousands of forehand wrist and snapshots in their driveways. They might take a few dozen backhands.
Right.
Consequently, the neuromuscular pathways for the backhand are underdeveloped. The shot feels awkward and weak, so they avoid using it in game situations, which ensures it remains awkward and weak.
A vicious cycle. Let's fix the mechanics then.
Yep.
I find I always flub it off the toe.
That is the most common error. Modern stick blades are heavily curved for forehand control, which means the back of the blade is convex and incredibly difficult to shoot off of.
So what's the trick?
You have to locate the flat spot on the back of your blade, which is typically from the heel to the middle. You must slide your bottom hand slightly wider down the shaft to gain leverage, because the human body naturally lacks torque on a backhand motion.
That makes sense.
And keep the puck incredibly close to your skates. If you reach your arms out away from your core, you instantly bleed all your power.
Keep it tight.
Sweep it tightly across your body in an arc, rolling the puck from the heel toward the toe.
And the reason an elite backhand is so terrifying to a goaltender goes right back to the telemetry we discussed earlier.
Yes. It creates a total blackout of information.
A blackout.
Goalies calibrate their visual tracking entirely around forehand releases. A backhand completely alters the release point.
There's no tell.
There is almost zero telegraphing in the shoulders, and the sweeping motion forces the goalie to track the puck awkwardly across their own body center line. It provides the goalie with virtually no usable data to set their angle.
Okay, so synthesizing the core arsenal. We use a wrist shot for pinpoint accuracy, remembering that the dynamic follow-through steers the height. We use the snapshot as the high-speed, modern default when time is scarce. And we must put in the deliberate reps to develop the backhand, turning a neglected motion into the ultimate weapon of deception.
That is the foundation. But inevitably, players want to talk about the heavy artillery. We have to address the high-risk arsenal.
Yes. Section 3 of our mental model. Let's look at slap shots, one-timers, and something I found utterly mind-blowing in the source material. The incredibly dangerous labyrinth of high-sticking rules that govern these big swings.
Oh, the rules get crazy here.
Let's start with the slap shot itself. The source material basically implies we shouldn't be using it very often.
It is the most cinematic shot in hockey and the most strategically overused.
But it's so fun.
It is. Yes, it produces the highest raw velocity, but the strategic trade-offs are immense. It takes an eternity to wind up, providing the goalie and every defender with massive amounts of warning.
Right.
It is notoriously inaccurate, and the failure state is catastrophic.
What do you mean by the failure state?
Consider the outcome of a missed slap shot from the point. If you take a massive swing and miss the net wide, that 90-mile-per-hour puck rings around the end boards with incredible force and often flies all the way out of your offensive zone.
Oh, right.
You have just single-handedly killed your team's sustained pressure. Right. A controlled three-quarter windup or a heavy snapshot keeps the puck in play and generates rebounds.
But if a player is determined to take one, what is the biomechanical secret? Because I watch beginners wind up and they seem to just chop directly down onto the puck.
Chopping directly at the puck is an arm-powered slap. It bypasses the technology of the stick entirely.
So where should you hit?
To execute a proper slap shot, your blade must strike the ice surface 2 to 5 centimeters, roughly an inch or two behind the puck.
Wait, you were intentionally hitting the ice first?
It is mandatory. By striking the rigid ice surface with downward force, you violently flex the carbon fiber shaft of the stick.
Loading the spring again?
Yes. The stick loads that immense kinetic energy. The player shifts their weight entirely through the shot, and as the shaft snaps forward to return to its straight shape, the blade aggressively catches the puck.
That makes total sense.
The puck is essentially propelled by the recoil of the stick, not just the swing of the arms.
Now apply those mechanics to the one-timer. A one-timer is effectively a slap shot taken on a moving target without stopping the puck first. It feels like the timing window is impossibly small.
It is the single fastest method of moving a puck laterally across the offensive zone. The timing is everything, and the fatal flaw most players make is waiting for visual confirmation.
Visual confirmation.
They watch the pass slide across the ice, wait for it to arrive at their feet, and then they begin their backswing.
If you wait for it to arrive, you're already late.
You are hopelessly late. You have to commit early. You must anchor your feet into a shooting stance before the puck reaches you.
Be ready before it gets there.
Exactly. If your states are still moving to adjust, you are receiving a pass, not executing a one-timer. The critical key is to begin your upward backswing at the exact moment your teammate releases the pass so that your downward strike intersects perfectly with the puck's arrival.
But hockey is chaotic. Passes are rarely perfect. What if the pass is lagging behind me or it's bouncing wildly on edge?
The elite cognitive choice is to abort the one-timer.
Just don't take it.
Exactly. If you reach backward to wildly swing at a lagging pass, you will likely whiff entirely. If you attempt to one-time a rapidly bouncing puck, the physics almost guarantee you will shank it into the corner netting.
So what do you do instead?
In those imperfect scenarios, you must cup your blade, use soft hands to absorb the erratic energy, settle the puck for half a second, and immediately fire a snapshot.
A delayed snapshot on target is infinitely more valuable than a spectacular swing at air.
Well said.
Which brings us to the most fascinating and frankly terrifying part of this deep dive.
The rulebook labyrinth.
Let's say I don't abort. I take that wild swing at a bouncing puck, or I take a massive slap shot in heavy traffic. My stick naturally follows through high in the air. I always assumed that if I am in the act of shooting, a high follow-through is perfectly legal, even if it accidentally clips someone.
That is the single most dangerous assumption an amateur hockey player can make.
Really?
Yes. Mm. The rule books governing high sticks during a shooting motion are a tangled, contradictory labyrinth. If you assume you are protected by a universal follow-through rule, you are going to cost your team games, and you might get yourself suspended.
Yeah. Okay, we have to break this down by the specific governing bodies.
Let's do it.
Let's untangle it. Start at the top. The NHL and the IIHF, the international rules.
In the NHL and IIHF rulebooks, there is a specific carve-out for shooters. They explicitly state that accidental contact made above the shoulders is permitted if it occurs during a normal wind-up or follow-through of a shooting motion.
Okay, so if I'm playing under those rules, I'm safe to swing away.
Not entirely. Even within that permissive rule, there is a strict caveat. Both books explicitly state that a wild swing at a bouncing puck is not considered a normal shooting motion.
Ah.
So if you ignore the advice to abort a bad one-timer, take a wild baseball swing at a puck waist high, and hit a defender in the face, the referee will penalize you.
That makes sense.
Furthermore, in the IIHF, if the referee determines your swing was recklessly endangering your opponent, they can bypass a minor penalty entirely and assess a major penalty plus an automatic game misconduct.
Your night is over, even if you didn't cause an injury.
Exactly.
Okay, but most of our listeners aren't playing in the NHL. A huge portion of recreational and youth hockey in the United States operates under USA Hockey rules. Do they have the same carve-out for a normal follow-through?
They absolutely do not.
Really?
USA Hockey prioritizes safety and control above all else. There is no carve-out for a shooting motion in the USA Hockey playing rules or their official casebook.
Wait, my brain is struggling with the implications of that. If I take a totally normal wrist shot, my stick follows through naturally, and a defender skates into my blade, I get a penalty.
Yes, but it gets stricter.
Stricter than that.
Under USA Hockey, you don't even necessarily need to make physical contact with an opponent to receive a penalty.
I can get 2 minutes in the box just for lifting my stick high in the air.
Yes. Casebook situation 2 explicitly clarifies that contact is not required if the player is deemed careless or reckless with their stick.
Wow.
Now, there is a known contradiction printed in their own rule book. A note attached to the rule suggests contact is required, but referees are instructed to enforce the stricter interpretation regarding safety.
And if you do hit someone?
If your follow-through does make contact and causes an injury, USA Hockey referees can escalate it to a major penalty plus a game misconduct or even a match penalty for reckless endangerment.
That is heavy. What about north of the border? What is the standard in Hockey Canada?
Hockey Canada also provides no carve-out for the follow-through. If your stick hits an opponent above the normal height of the shoulders, it is a penalty, regardless of whether you were shooting.
Okay, so no carve-out there either.
No. And in minor and female hockey divisions in Canada, it escalates even further. It triggers the head contact rule, which supersedes almost every other rule in the book.
Head contact rule.
Yeah. Under that mandate, if your high stick causes an injury, it is a mandatory major penalty and an automatic game misconduct.
Okay, let's push this to the extreme. What if I am playing in a Canadian adult recreational league, the classic beer league, governed by Carhartt rules?
Carhartt rules are the most punitive of all. To prevent these dangerous follow-throughs entirely, Carhartt Rule 79A bans the slap shot outright.
Banned entirely.
Any backswing that raises the blade more than 15 inches off the ice is an immediate minor penalty.
A complete ban on the shot itself.
Yes, but the penalty for accidentally hitting someone is staggering. If you violate the ban, take a slap shot, and your stick injures an opponent, Carco mandates an automatic major penalty.
Ouch.
And here is the cascade effect. Under Carrier rules, any major penalty automatically carries a game misconduct, ejecting you from the current game.
Right.
And any game misconduct tied to a major penalty automatically triggers a one-game suspension for your next game.
Just to be perfectly clear, if I forget the local rules, take a slap shot, and my follow-through accidentally clips a guy on the chin, I am...
I point to a separate rule that offers leniency for an accidental high stick, but because the slap shot itself was an illegal infraction, that leniency is voided.
That is brutal.
Furthermore, Carrier does not even offer the referee the option of a 2-minute minor for high sticking a person above the shoulders. If your stick hits a player above the shoulder, it is an automatic major penalty, period.
The strategic takeaway here is profound. When you are deciding whether to take a massive swing in traffic, you aren't just calculating the physics of the shot, you have to calculate your legal exposure. If you don't know exactly which of these rule books governs your specific league, a single wild swing can result in a turnover, a major penalty, an ejection, and a suspension. When in doubt, use a compact snapshot.
Know your rule book. It is as important as knowing your stick flex.
Let's shift our focus to the geometry of the offensive zone. We have established how to shoot efficiently, and we know how to avoid getting suspended while doing it.
Good start.
Yeah. But flawless mechanics are utterly useless if you apply them from the wrong location. Let's build a spatial map of probabilities.
Location dictates probability, and the analytics paint a very stark, undeniable picture.
Where is the best spot?
The highest value real estate on the ice is the slot. That's the central area extending from the crease out to the faceoff dots between the circles. Shots originating from the slot convert into goals at a rate of roughly 10 to 15%.
And how does that compare to the perimeter, like the outside edges of the zone along the boards?
Shots from the perimeter convert at roughly 2 to 4%.
The disparity is staggering. A shot from the slot is statistically 3 to 7 times more likely to result in a goal.
The models are incredibly consistent on this gap. To put into an even sharper perspective, let's look at the point, the area near the blue line.
Right, where the defensemen play.
Shots taken from the point convert at a mere 1 to 3%.
Now, hold on. I have to challenge this. We watch NHL games every night, and we see elite defensemen bombing slap shots from the blue line constantly.
Yes, we do.
Are professional coaches just ignoring the analytics, or is there a secondary purpose to a point shot?
Yeah, it is an excellent observation. The point shot is not broken. Its purpose is just misunderstood by amateurs.
How so?
When an NHL defenseman shoots from the blue line, their primary goal is rarely to score cleanly. At a 1 to 3% conversion rate, that would be terrible strategy.
So why shoot?
Their actual objective is to engineer chaos. They are firing the puck low into a crowded area specifically to generate a deflection, create a rebound, or force a scramble in the slot. The point shot is an assist mechanism, not a finishing mechanism.
The source material provides a brilliant real-world example using tracking data from SportLogic, focusing on elite snipers like Patrick Kane and Patrick Laine.
Yes. Over a multi-year tracking period, the data revealed that these world-class shooters scored less than 2% of their total goals from the dead zone located above the tops of the face-off circles.
2%.
The takeaway for the listener is brutal, but necessary. If Patrick Kane, with his generational mechanics, cannot consistently score from the perimeter, you certainly cannot.
So the behavioral shift is clear. If I have the puck on the perimeter and I can take 2 hard strides to cross into the slot before shooting, I must take those strides.
Always.
And if I am locked on the perimeter, but I have a teammate open in the slot, I have to pass the puck. I am literally trading a 2% lottery ticket for a 15% high yield investment.
It is basic offensive mathematics, but we have to look deeper than just static location dots on a map.
Okay, what's deeper?
We have to look at how moving the puck fundamentally alters the goaltender's physical geometry. This brings us to a concept heavily popularized by former NHL goaltender turned analyst Steve Valiquette, the Royal Road.
I love this concept. Visualize an imaginary line running straight down the exact center of the ice from one net to the other, dividing the rink longitudinally into 2 halves.
Now, I should note that the sources mention a slight technical dispute regarding the exact mapping of this line.
Like where it ends.
Right. Valaket's original definition stated the line stops at the tops of the face-off circles, while the broader coaching consensus often draws it continuously from net to net.
But the idea is the same.
However, the mechanical principle remains identical regardless of where you cap it.
The principle being that crossing this line is a goaltender's worst nightmare.
Exactly. When an attacking team forces the puck across this center longitudinal line, either via a crisp lateral pass or a skater carrying it across it, demands an immense physical and cognitive response from the goaltender.
What do they have to do?
They cannot simply pivot. They must violently push laterally to traverse their crease, stop their momentum on a dime, reestablish their vertical depth, recalculate their geometric angle to the new origin point, and visually reacquire the puck.
All in a fraction of a second.
Yes.
It effectively forces a total reboot of their tracking telemetry.
Yes. Valaket's proprietary tracking data claimed that green shots, his term for shots taken immediately after the puck crosses the Royal Road, account for a staggering 76% of all NHL goals.
Now, as an analytical thinker, I have to raise an eyebrow at that 76% figure.
It's a huge number.
It is. And the sources responsibly caveat that this is proprietary data, meaning independent analysts can't audit the methodology. It's highly likely that the 76% include a massive correlation with other chaotic factors, like screens, broken defensive coverages, and defensive breakdowns that inherently happen during cross-ice passes.
That skepticism is entirely warranted. It is almost certainly a correlation rather than a pure isolated causation.
Right.
But the underlying biomechanical truth is universally embraced by goalie coaches everywhere. If you force a goaltender to move laterally across their center axis immediately prior to a shot, their save percentage plummets.
And this connects perfectly back to our earlier discussion about the one-timer. Why is the one-timer so devastating? It is the ultimate manifestation of the Royal Road principle.
It really is.
The pass forces the puck across the center line faster than the goaltender's physiology can physically slide and anchor.
Back.
You are marrying the speed of the release with the geometric disadvantage of the lateral push.
A brilliant synthesis. You are stacking multiple advantages. Now let's look at the geometry of shooting through traffic.
Okay, so I'm on the point.
Right? You are on the point. You have a 1% chance of scoring cleanly. You need to shoot to create a rebound. What is the precise order of operations?
Because I see amateur defensemen constantly blast the puck directly into the shin pads of the forward standing 3 feet in front of them.
Shooting into a defender's shin pads is the worst possible outcome of an offensive possession.
Because it bounces right back.
You immediately lose the puck, the goaltender isn't forced to work, and the ricochet almost always jump starts a high-speed counterattack for the opposition.
Right, a breakaway for them.
The rigid order of operations must be identify the lane first and shoot second.
You cannot just fire blindly and hope it threads the needle.
Never. You must visually confirm a clear path to the net or to your teammate's stick. If a defending player is occupying your direct lane, you must take one or two lateral steps along the blue line before shooting.
Walk the line, as they say.
Yes. The defender has positioned their stick and body to block the angle you are occupying. A single, sharp lateral step completely rewrites the geometry and opens a new lane.
And once I find that lane, what is the optimal height for this shot?
Knee height or below.
Keep it low.
Always. If you shoot a puck waist high or chest high through traffic, it is physically impossible for your forwards to safely tip it, and it usually results in an easy glove save for the goalie.
But low shots cause trouble.
A low, hard shot forces the goalie to use their leg pads, which generates rebounds, and it gives your net front players a chance to deflect it.
Which provides the perfect bridge to the next critical phase of scoring.
Net front chaos.
Yes. If point shots only convert at 1 to 3%, the players standing directly in front of the net are the ones carrying the heavy burden of converting those low shots into goals.
They do the dirty work.
But the source material makes it terrifyingly clear that the area directly in front of the net is the most highly regulated, legally perilous real estate on the ice.
It is a true minefield down there.
Let's start with the physical mechanics of deflections and tips, and then we will dive into the rule book.
Mechanically, the biggest mistake a player makes when attempting a tip is swinging their stick at the incoming puck.
You're not trying to hit a baseball.
Exactly. You must present a static, intentionally angled blade face. If you want to deflect the puck upward over the goalie's shoulder, you open the face of the blade.
Tilt it back.
If you want to deflect a high shot downward between their pads, you close the face.
And the sources emphasize the concept of soft hands. What does that mean in terms of physics?
It relates to energy absorption. If you grip your stick with maximum rigidity and brace your arms, your stick acts like a concrete wall.
The puck just pings off it.
The high-speed puck impacts the rigid blade and violently ricochets off into the corner boards, completely away from the danger zone.
So how do you fix that?
To execute a proper tip, you must hold the stick with soft hands, allowing your grip and your arms to yield slightly upon impact. This absorbs a significant portion of the puck's kinetic energy.
I see.
If your deflection doesn't beat the goalie directly, that absorbed energy causes the puck to drop softly right at your skates for an easy secondary rebound.
The golden rule being, a late change in direction is infinitely more valuable than trying to add extra speed to the puck.
Exactly. But now we have to introduce the legal constraints, specifically regarding how high you are permitted to raise your stick to tip a puck.
Once again, the major rulebooks diverge wildly.
Completely different rules.
Let's set the scenario. A teammate fires a point shot. It's coming in high. I raise the blade of my stick into the air, deflect the puck downward, and it bounces into the net. What determines if that is a legal goal?
If you are playing under NHL, IIHF, or Hockey Canada rules, the absolute limit for a legal goal deflection is the exact height of the goal's crossbar.
The crossbar.
If the puck makes contact with any part of your stick at or below the level of the crossbar and proceeds into the net, it is a good goal.
Wait, clarify this for me. What if the handle of my stick is way up above my helmet, but the blade is down low and the puck hits the blade?
Under those three rule books, that is a perfectly legal goal. The determining factor is strictly the point of contact between the puck and the stick relative to the crossbar.
The overall height of the stick shaft is irrelevant.
Correct.
Okay, now let's apply the exact same physical scenario to USA Hockey.
Under USA Hockey Rule 621D, the legal limit is not the crossbar. The limit is the normal height of your shoulders.
That alone is a massive difference.
It is. But it becomes incredibly strict when you read their official casebook situation 7. It states that if any part of your stick is carried above the height of your shoulders, the entire stick is legally considered high.
So if I have the blade of my stick raised above my head in the air, but the puck actually strikes the lower shaft of my stick down near my waist and deflects into the net.
Under USA Hockey, that goal is instantly disallowed.
Even though the contact was at my waist.
Yes. Even though the physical contact occurred at waist height, the fact that a portion of the stick was above your shoulders renders the entire apparatus illegal for that play.
It is a stunning contrast. The exact same physical event is a clean goal in Toronto and a disallowed goal in Chicago.
Exactly.
And what happens if the puck doesn't go in? What if I'm just in the defensive zone and I bat a puck out of the air with a high stick to stop a pass?
We enter the complex rules regarding whistle stoppages and possession.
Oh boy.
In the NHL, IIHF, and Hockey Canada, batting a puck with a high stick does not trigger an automatic whistle.
It doesn't.
No, play only stops if a player from the offending team is the first to gain possession and control of that batted puck. If you bat it and an opposing player intercepts it, the referee yells play on and the game continues.
Does USA Hockey follow that possession rule?
It is somewhat confusing. The written USA Hockey rulebook states that batting the puck with a stick above the shoulders causes an immediate stoppage of play. However, their corresponding casebook walks that back and clarifies that it is actually a possession test, similar to the NHL.
The real punishment, though, isn't just the whistle. It's where the referee places the face-off afterward.
Yes, this is where USA Hockey is brutal.
What do they do?
If you commit a high stick violation in the attacking zone under IIHF rules, the ensuing face-off is typically placed in the neutral zone just outside the blue line. You lose your zone pressure.
But USA Hockey is different.
Under USA Hockey, the referee drags the face-off all the way back into your own defensive zone. You forfeit the entire 200-foot length of the ice as a penalty for the high stick.
It is a massive territorial penalty. Okay, let's examine the other major component of net front chaos, screening the goalie. The infamous Rule 69, goalie interference.
This one causes so many arguments.
The tactical goal of a screen is obvious.
Yeah.
Stand just outside the blue paint of the crease, completely block the goaltender's line of sight, and avoid physically touching them.
Right.
If executed perfectly, it is arguably the most valuable non-puck action in the sport.
It blinds the telemetry systems we talked about, but players constantly push the boundary, trying to get closer to the goalie.
Let's untangle Rule 69.
In the NHL and IIHF, establishing a visual screen from outside the physical boundaries of the crease, assuming zero contact is made, is perfectly legal.
As long as you stay out.
However, if you step inside the blue paint, the calculus changes. The rule dictates that if an attacking player establishes a significant position within the crease that obstructs the goalie's vision and impairs their ability to defend the net, any resulting goal must be disallowed.
What about the boundary line itself? The red line that outlines the blue paint. Can I anchor my skates directly on the red line?
This exposes a fascinating contradiction in the international rules.
Of course it does.
If you consult the visual reference tables in the back of the IIHF and NHL rulebooks, they explicitly illustrate that an attacking player planted on the crease line who screens the goalie is in a legal position. The goal should count.
Okay, so the picture says it's fine.
However, if you read the actual text of IIHF Rule 1.7, it explicitly defines the red boundary line as being an integral part of the goal crease. Therefore, the written rule contradicts the reference table.
So what is the practical advice for a player who doesn't want to leave it up to a referee's interpretation?
The only safe tactical advice is to stay completely off the red line. Anchor your skates firmly in the white ice.
And what if I accidentally bump the goalie?
In the NHL and IIHF, the crease is the goaltender sanctuary. If you initiate contact with a goaltender while they are established inside their crease and a goal is scored, it will be voided.
Even if it's an accident.
Even if the contact was entirely incidental. The only marginal exception is a genuine loose puck scramble. But even then, you are absolutely prohibited from using your body mass to push the goalie or their pads backward into the net.
Are USA Hockey and Hockey Canada stricter regarding crease violations?
Exponentially stricter. USA Hockey Rule 625B removes almost all subjective interpretation.
What's the rule?
It dictates that if an attacking player's skate is inside the crease, the goal is voided, period.
Just the skate.
It does not matter if you made contact. It does not matter if you impaired their vision. If your skate blade touches the paint and the puck didn't precede you into the crease, the goal comes off the board.
That is striking.
You can even cause a whistle and a neutral zone faceoff simply by skating completely through the crease without the puck while your team is on offense.
It's a binary rule. You're either in or out in Hockey Canada.
Hockey Canada permits you to stand inside the crease, provided you are completely passive and do not interfere. However, they are draconian regarding contact.
Contact anywhere.
If an attacking player initiates contact with a goaltender anywhere on the ice surface, even if the goalie has wandered far outside their crease to play the puck, the goal is voided.
Wow. They extend the sanctuary to the entire rink.
Yes. And we must emphasize the safety mandate present across all four major rule books.
What's that?
If an attacking player recklessly charges into the goaltender within the crease, they are facing a major penalty and a game misconduct. Hockey Canada makes that ejection strictly mandatory.
You can screen, but you can't hit.
You can use your body to block their eyes, but you can never use your kinetic energy to physically punish the goaltender.
The spatial awareness required here is incredible. Your ability to execute a soft hands deflection is irrelevant if your left skate is 1 inch over a red line that you didn't realize was illegal in your specific league.
Spatial awareness is a fundamental component of cognitive shot selection.
Which brings us perfectly to the ultimate test of cognitive and mechanical skill. We have analyzed traffic, screens, and chaos. But what happens when the chaos evaporates and it is a pure one-on-one duel between the shooter and the goalie?
The fun stuff.
Yeah. Let's discuss shooting off the rush, breakaways, and the shootout, starting with the rush carrying the puck down the wing against a retreating defender.
The most prevalent error amateur players make on the rush is an over-reliance on patience.
Waiting too long.
As you accelerate down the wing, the defender is pivoting backward, actively attempting to close the spatial gap and extending their stick to disrupt your lane.
Right.
Many shooters will hold the puck, waiting until they reach a better spot closer to the net before firing. By the time they reach that spot, the defender's stick has fully entered the shooting lane and the shot is blocked.
You have allowed the defense to dictate the timing. So what is the counter strategy?
You must release the puck as the defender's stick is actively closing the gap, not after it has arrived.
Use them as a screen.
This is the absolute perfect scenario to deploy the wrong foot release we discussed earlier. You keep your feet driving, you use the defender's moving body as a partial visual screen against the goalie, and you snap the shot off mid-stride, a fraction of a second, before either the defender or the goalie expects it.
But what if there is no defender at all? A clean, unopposed breakaway from center ice.
The mental game here is huge.
The psychology of this moment is fascinating. The source material frames it as a high-speed game of poker, where the goalie's entire objective is to force you to reveal your hand first.
It is pure psychological warfare. A technically sound goaltender will aggressively skate out toward the top of their crease to challenge your angle, and then perfectly match your forward speed while retreating backward, remaining upright.
They're mirroring you.
They are establishing a neutral state. They are waiting for you to initiate a deke or a shot so they can react with maximum efficiency. Your overarching strategy must be the mirror image. You have to construct an approach that forces them to commit first.
How do I force that commitment? My instinct on a breakaway is to just skate as fast as humanly possible so the defense can't catch me.
That instinct is the enemy of a successful breakaway. Raw linear speed is completely misunderstood by shooters. If you execute a breakaway at absolute maximum speed, you ruin your own chances.
Walk me through the mechanics of why speed is bad.
It requires a three-phase approach to understand. Phase one, as you cross center ice and hit the offensive blue line, you absolutely come in hard.
Show them speed.
You show the goaltender maximum terrifying speed to force them deep into their defensive posture. But phase two is the secret. As you cross the blue line and approach the top of the faceoff circles, you must actively ease off the accelerator.
Zeta.
You want to arrive at the high slot carrying less speed than you intuitively feel you should.
Why intentionally slow down in the most critical zone?
For three distinct reasons. First, cognitive processing time. If you are traveling at max speed, your brain has zero time to read the goaltender's depth or positioning. You are forced to pre-decide your move before you even cross the blue line, which is a terrible strategic gamble.
Oh, that makes sense. You can't read the play.
Second, flying in a predictable straight line at terminal velocity gives the goaltender the easiest possible visual read. Their brain can easily calculate exactly where your mass will be in half a second.
And then the third reason.
Pure physics. If you decide to execute a wide deke, you require physical space to pull the puck across your body. If you are moving at max speed, you will literally run out of available ice and crash violently into the goalpost before you can finish the move.
Okay, so I've shown speed and then I've decelerated at the circles. What is phase three?
Phase three is acceleration into the final move. The sequence is fast, slow, fast.
Fast, slow, fast.
That sudden change of pace utterly destroys the goaltender's carefully matched backward rhythm. A change of pace is infinitely deadlier than raw linear speed.
So I have disrupted their physical rhythm. Now I need to deceive their vision. Should I be throwing aggressive head and shoulder fakes?
Head bobs and shoulder shimmies are the cheapest, least effective tricks in hockey.
Really? I see guys do it all the time.
Elite goaltenders are specifically trained to ignore your upper body. They watch your core, your hips, and the puck itself. If you want to genuinely deceive a goalie, you must manipulate the position of the puck.
How so?
Pull it sharply from your forehand to your backhand. Alternatively, you can physically sell a shot.
How do you sell a shot without actually shooting?
You simulate the biomechanical load. Drop your bottom hand down the shaft and aggressively push down, visibly flexing the stick against the ice.
Wow, make it look heavy.
When a goaltender's visual telemetry registers that carbon fiber shaft bowing, their subconscious brain instinctively screams impact. They will violently freeze their feet or drop aggressively into the butterfly stance to seal the five hole.
On them.
The millisecond they freeze to brace for the shot, you smoothly pull the puck around them.
That is a brilliant manipulation of their internal triggers. Okay, let's talk about move selection. Because I see amateur players attempt their one favorite fancy deke, regardless of what the goalie's actually doing.
Which is a catastrophic failure of cognitive shot selection. Your physical move must be a direct response to the goaltender's behavior.
Let's run through the scenarios.
If the goalie is playing aggressively, challenging you far out beyond the blue paint, you deploy a wide forehand backhand deke.
Why?
Because by coming out aggressively, they have surrendered the geometric space behind them. You have the room to navigate around their extended pads.
What if the goalie plays conservatively, staying deep in their crease and remaining perfectly square?
Then you shoot the puck. If you attempt a sweeping deke against a deeply anchored goalie, you will find no space behind them. You will simply skate yourself into an impossible angle in the corner or right into the post.
What if they are actively pushing laterally to match your angle?
If they're in the middle of a lateral push, you shoot for the five hole, the space between their leg pads.
It opens up naturally.
The mechanics of a lateral push naturally force the five hole to open slightly mid-stride. However, if they've already dropped and set firmly into the butterfly stance, Do not shoot five hole. That space is hermetically sealed.
The sources offer a fantastic piece of overarching advice here. Mastering one single reliable go-to move that you can execute in your sleep is vastly superior to half-knowing five complex moves.
Without question. Build one primary move until it is autonomic, and then build one reliable counter move that attacks the opposite side.
Let's transition to the shootout. A shootout is essentially a sterile, legally controlled breakaway. What does the NHL rulebook mandate for a shootout attempt?
NHL Rule 24 governs penalty shots and shootouts, and it is built on one inviolable principle. The puck must maintain continuous forward motion toward the goal line.
No going backwards.
You cannot stop, you cannot circle back to center ice, and you cannot curl away from the net to reset your angle.
But what are the rules regarding rebounds?
There are absolutely no rebounds permitted. Your initial shot is your only legal opportunity. The play is considered dead the instant the puck comes to a complete stop or makes contact with the goaltender, resulting in a save.
Are there any exceptions?
There is only one obscure, tiny exception. If the puck strikes the post or the crossbar, violently ricochets back, hits the goaltender's back or equipment, and crosses a line, it is a good goal.
Like a pinball effect. Can I execute the famous 360-degree spinorama move?
Not in the modern NHL. The league explicitly banned it because it technically violates the continuous forward motion rule. If you attempt a full spin, the referee will instantly blow the whistle.
What about the Michigan?
Interestingly, the highly controversial Michigan or lacrosse-style move where a player scoops the puck onto the blade and carries it in the air is perfectly legal during a shootout, provided you keep the stick below the legal height limit of the crossbar and shoulders.
Okay, that covers the NHL. But I know we have international listeners, and the source material specifically highlights some fascinating variations in UK rules. Are international shootouts identical?
They are quite different structurally. The NHL utilizes a three-round shootout format before advancing to sudden death. The IIHF, for events like the World Championships, mandates a five-round shootout.
What about the UK?
But if you look at the United Kingdom, specifically the British in-house rules governing leagues like the NIHL, they utilize a three-round format, but with a massive strategic twist regarding player usage.
In the NHL, a coach has to exhaust every single player on the bench before anyone is allowed to shoot a second time.
Correct. But under current UK rules, specifically the 2026-27 edition, noted in the sources once the initial three rounds are completed, a coach is permitted to reuse the exact same shooter repeatedly.
Wait, really?
If you have one elite shootout specialist, they can legally take the fourth shot, the fifth shot, and the sixth shot.
That fundamentally alters the coaching strategy of a tied game.
It entirely changes the math. And for our recreational players listening, a quick note on house rules. Always confirm the starting location of a shootout in a rec league.
Because some start closer.
Many leagues require you to start from the blue line rather than center ice to save time. A shorter runway severely limits your ability to execute the slow-fast change of pace approach.
You just don't have the room.
In a blue line shootout, you should strongly bias your strategy toward a quick, deceptive snapshot rather than a complex, multi-stage deke.
That is highly practical advice. Which brings us to the final piece of our mental model. Mastery, equipment, and the vital skill of knowing when not to shoot.
The hardest lesson of all.
We have spent the last hour giving the listener an incredible array of offensive weapons. But perhaps the hardest skill for an aggressive player to learn is restraint.
Restraint is the ultimate hallmark of a mature, elite player. A general shoot-first mentality is structurally sound, but forcing a low-probability shot simply because the puck happens to be on your blade is detrimental to your team.
Is there a mental checklist a player can use to determine if a shot is worth taking?
You must ask yourself one split-second question before initiating the release. What is the likely outcome if the shot does not go in?
You evaluate the failure state.
Exactly. If the answer is, my teammate is positioned for a rebound in the slot, or we will generate a dangerous tip, or the puck will ring safely into the corner where we can recover it, then you take the shot.
And if it's bad?
But if the answer is, it is going to strike the shin pads of the defender standing 3 feet in front of me, and they will immediately break out on a two-on-one counterattack, you absolutely must not shoot.
So if I am the last player back on defense hovering near the blue line, and I take a wild, low-percentage slap shot that misses the net entirely.
You have just single-handedly created an odd-man rush going the other way. Never deploy a shot if the probable miss creates a high-danger transition for the opponent.
In recall or geometric analytics, If you are trapped on the perimeter and a teammate is fighting for space in the high slot, pass the puck. You are actively trading a 2% mathematical probability for a 15% probability. It is simple, undeniable math.
Let's touch briefly on equipment, because hockey players are notorious for blaming their sticks for their own poor mechanics.
Oh, always the stick's fault.
You cannot buy a stick to replace deliberate practice. However, you must ensure your stick's flex and lie are appropriate for your body.
Let's define those. Flex refers to the stiffness of the carbon fiber shaft.
Yes. If you purchase a stick that is too stiff for your body weight and strength, you will be physically incapable of bowing the shaft to load energy. Your wrist shot degrades into an arms-only push.
And if it's too soft?
Conversely, if the stick is too soft, it behaves like a wet noodle, fluttering under pressure and destroying your accuracy. You should be able to noticeably load the flex during a firm, standard wrist shot.
And what exactly is the lie of the stick?
The lie dictates the angle at which the blade attaches to the shaft. To test it, stand in your natural athletic skating posture on the ice. The entire bottom edge of the blade from heel to toe must rest perfectly flat against the ice surface.
What if it doesn't?
If the toe is pointing up in the air or the heel is hovering off the ice, your fundamental mechanics will be compromised on every single touch of the puck, and no amount of technique can overcome that geometric flaw.
Speaking of technique, let's discuss practice methodology. Because the source material draws a very sharp, distinct line between volume practice and deliberate practice.
Volume practice consists of standing in your driveway, firing 1,000 pucks at a static piece of plywood.
Just getting reps in.
It is absolutely necessary for beginners to build gross motor patterns, grooving the weight transfer, strengthening the wrist roll. But volume alone will not forge a dangerous in-game goal score.
Because it lacks the chaos of a game environment.
Precisely. In a live game, you are never afforded a perfectly flat, static puck with zero defensive pressure. Deliberate practice builds the applicable in-game skill.
Give me an example of deliberate practice.
Deliberate practice means calling your shot out loud, shouting low blocker before you initiate the release, forcing immediate accountability for your accuracy. It means intentionally practicing the wrong foot release until it feels natural.
Or practicing bad passes?
Yes, it means having a partner fire terrible, bouncing, erratic passes at your skates and forcing yourself to absorb them and snap them off in half a second.
And the sources heavily emphasize dedicating 50% of your practice time entirely to the backhand.
If you force a 50-50 split of forehand and backhand reps for just 1 month, your backhand will transform from a nervous liability into your most deceptive weapon.
Now, I want to end this section with a massive critical caution from the source material regarding practice environments, specifically team warm-ups. It involves physical safety and a terrifying reality of the rulebook.
Oh, this is so important.
Let's say we are in pregame warm-ups. I take a high, hard shot, and it accidentally strikes our goaltender squarely in the face mask. Doesn't the referee immediately blow the whistle to stop play and ensure the goalie isn't concussed?
This is a widespread and incredibly dangerous misconception among amateur players. You absolutely cannot rely on a referee's whistle if you strike a goaltender in the mask.
Wait, really? There is no automatic stoppage?
Under the rules of the NHL, the USA Hockey Stand-Up Rulebook, and CARA's Adult Rec Rules, there is strictly NO mask-specific stoppage mandate.
But surely the general injury rules cover a headshot.
Every rulebook contains a provision to halt play for a seriously injured player. But here is the fatal flaw in relying on that. Those general injury rules require the referee to visually judge and confirm that the player is actually incapacitated.
But they're wearing a mask.
Exactly. If a goaltender absorbs a 90-mile-per-hour shot to the cage, but manages to stay upright on their knees or skates, the referee cannot physically see their eyes or their face behind the mask to determine if they are dazed, disoriented, or actively concussed.
So the play just organically continues, while the goalie might be virtually unconscious on their feet.
Extremely often, yes. The IHF is the only major adult rule book that includes a specific rule addressing mask impacts, and even then, the language uses the word may, not shall.
They may stop play.
The referee may stop play if they perceive the goalie is dazed, but only if an immediate scoring opportunity is not in progress. Hockey Canada is the only governing body that mandates an automatic stoppage for a mask impact, and critically, that rule only applies to U13 youth hockey and younger.
That is an incredibly sobering reality check. The system is not designed to protect the goaltender fast enough. Do not fire pucks at your goalie's head during warm-ups.
It is the ultimate act of disrespect to your most important teammate.
We have covered an immense expanse of tactical and technical ground today. Let's synthesize all of this into a final, coherent framework.
To master the art of shooting, you must seamlessly integrate three distinct disciplines. First, biomechanics. Engineering a fast disguise release that short-circuits the goaltender's internal clock, utilizing dynamic stick flex, lateral movement, and unpredictable weight transfers.
Okay, biomechanics. And the second?
Second, spatial geometry. Understanding the stark analytics of the high-yield slot versus the low-yield perimeter, and weaponizing the Royal Road and visual screens to force the goaltender into a mathematically disadvantageous position.
And the third?
And third, psychological warfare. Forcing the goaltender to commit their movement first on a breakaway, and varying your mechanics to shatter their visual reads.
And as we've learned, you have to execute all of that while balancing on the razor's edge of whichever specific contradictory rulebook is governing your game tonight. Your spatial awareness must map the exact borders of the blue paint, and your mechanical awareness must know the legal height limits of your follow-through to avoid ejection.
It is a phenomenal cognitive load.
All right, let's distill this deep dive into our core tenets. If you are going to carry anything onto the ice with you, remember these principles.
Number one, release speed will always beat shot speed. Deception is your primary offensive engine.
Number two, the snapshot is the modern default, providing slapshot concussiveness with wrist shot concealment.
Number three, on a wrist shot, your dynamic follow-through steers the trajectory. Do not obsess over the static angle of the blade at release.
Number four, the slapshot is mathematically overused. Always check your local rulebook for bans or severe high-sticking penalties before you commit to a full windup.
Number five, fight your way to the slot. A 15% conversion rate in the middle will infinitely outpace a 2% prayer from the boards.
Number six, force the goaltender to traverse the Royal Road or actively eliminate their visual telemetry with a well-placed screen.
Number seven, respect Rule 69. Know precisely where your skate blades are relative to the blue paint because the NHL and USA Hockey adjudicate that boundary completely differently.
Number eight, on a breakaway, weaponize your pace. Do not travel at terminal velocity the entire way. Decelerate at the circles to establish time, space, and a broken rhythm.
Number nine, dedicate deliberate practice to the backhand and intentionally practice receiving erratic, difficult passes to build real-world skill.
And number 10, never shoot high on your goaltender in warm-ups. The rulebook is not engineered to blow the whistle in time to prevent a severe injury. We began this deep dive discussing our cultural fascination with the radar gun and how we are mesmerized by the brute, visible metrics of a 100-mile-per-hour slapshot.
Yeah, that flashy radar gun.
But through this masterclass, we have uncovered that the true essence of goal scoring lives in the invisible microseconds. The disguised release mid-stride, the geometric disruption of a cross-ice pass, and the psychological chess match of a fast, slow-fast breakaway.
The hardest shooter on the rink is rarely the most dangerous. The smartest, most deceptive shooter always is.
I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over as you pack your gear bag for your next game. We know that goaltending is constantly evolving. They are analyzing high-speed video, optimizing their telemetry to better read our hips, our hands, and our stick flex.
They're always getting better.
And in response, shooters have evolved the snapshot and the wrong foot release to subvert those reads. So I ask you, what does the next frontier of shooter deception look like? In 5 or 10 years, when the snapshot has been optimized to its absolute physical limits, what completely new, totally unorthodox, biomechanical movement will the next generation of players invent to shatter the modern goaltender's internal clock?
It is a never-ending biomechanical arms race.
It truly is. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Take this mental model onto the ice, keep your head up, verify your local rulebook, and remember, always keep the goalie guessing. See you next time.